Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter in Washington. Today is November 30, 1979, and this is my AUDIO LETTER No. 52. Where will you be, my friends, if nuclear fireballs begin erupting soon over the United States of America? If war comes, will you be among the majority of Americans who will be caught by surprise, or will you be among the few who will have escaped from target areas in time? I pray that war will not come, but at this very moment the world is teetering dangerously close to thermonuclear catastrophe. And if it happens, air raid sirens and radio alerts will come too late. It will be like Hiroshima just after dawn on August 6, 1945. Radio Hiroshima began to broadcast an air raid alert, but never finished. It was cut short by the unearthly flash of a second dawn as a man-made sun rose over the city. These are the true stakes, my friends, in the present crisis over American hostages in Iran. The hostages are only helpless pawns in a deadly chess game behind the scenes. For more than 2 years now, a worldwide secret war has been underway. The secret war is between the new rulers of Russia and the overthrown rulers of Russia, the Bolsheviks, now here in America. Last month I reported that, quote, "the secret war may soon surface in very spectacular ways. When that happens, most people still will not know the reasons for what they see. But the events themselves will make headlines the world over," unquote. 8 days after I recorded those words in AUDIO LETTER No. 51, the present crisis in Iran suddenly began. The American embassy in Tehran was overrun, supposedly by Iranian students, and more than 60 hostages were taken. Today, more than 3 weeks later, some 50 Americans are still being held hostage. Day by day the crisis has deepened. On both sides, there has been confusion and one contradiction after another. Iran, like the United States, is speaking with several voices in the crisis because Iran, like the United States, is a battleground in this secret war. The real reason for the Iran crisis is one that I warned about 15 months ago in AUDIO LETTER No. 37. The Bolsheviks, here in America, have created a plan to launch an American nuclear first strike against Russia. The plan has been updated and revised continuously since I first revealed it in AUDIO LETTER No. 37, but the underlying military strategy has not changed at all, and Iran is an indispensable key to that strategy. The Bolsheviks intend for the Iran crisis to cause American and other troops to pour into Iran. As a pretext, we will be told that it has become necessary for America to seize Iran's oil fields and facilities to keep Iranian oil flowing. But the real purpose will be to get ready fast for a sneak attack on Russia. This is the real meaning of the Iran crisis, and yet the crisis so far is not going according to Bolshevik plan. For the past 6 months, the Russians have been seizing control of certain key positions of power here in the United States. Up to now, Russia's new rulers have relatively few agents here compared to the vast number of the Bolshevik enemies. But the Russians are working from the top down for maximum leverage. They were unable to prevent the Iran crisis, but they are using their new power here to alter its course. Up to now, the Russians have been able to keep their Bolshevik enemies here in America off balance in the Iran crisis. 2 months ago, in the crisis over Russian troops in Cuba, they were content to make the whole affair just fizzle out. But this time, the chess players in the Kremlin are shooting for checkmate. They are having to calculate their moves very quickly, but they are calculating carefully because their goal is to wreck the Bolshevik war plan built around Iran. Right now, my friends, the world is staggering along like a blindfolded man, only inches away from the unseen chasm of nuclear war. If the Russian maneuvering is successful, we will be pulled a step toward safety. But one wrong move and the Bolsheviks here in America will push us over the edge. My three special topics this month are Topic number 1, Strategic Iran and the Islamic Khomeini Revolution. Topic number 2, the Bolshevik Iran Strategy for Thermonuclear War. And Topic number 3, American Hostages and the Battle of Tehran. Topic number 1. The Iran crisis was triggered by an event here in the United States late last month. On October 22nd, the deposed Shah of Iran arrived in New York City, ostensibly for medical treatment. As a result, tempers boiled over fast in Iran, and in less than 2 weeks the United States Embassy in Tehran was attacked and seized. To understand the headlines of today about Iran, you need to know why and how the Shah was deposed. You deserve to know some key facts about the Khomeini government which the news media are not telling you. Also, there are certain things about the religion of Islam itself which you must know, because otherwise you will be unable to interpret what you see happening in the Iran crisis. Only a short 2 months ago, we Americans were preoccupied with a different crisis. We were worried not about American hostages in Iran, but about reports of a Russian combat brigade in Cuba. And a year ago this month, there was a fake alarm over Russian MiG-23 fighters in Cuba. Yet during the days of the Shah, Iran amounted to a super Cuba against Russia. Iran is 15 times the size of Cuba, with 3 times the population, and the Shah was turning it into an armed camp as an American puppet. The Iranian army was being whipped into a large modern fighting force. The very latest in America's supersonic fighters, the F-14, was being shipped to Iran in great numbers, complete with the advanced Phoenix missile. And the Iranian Navy was growing steadily. American-made warships were being shipped to Iran with equipment even more sophisticated than that supplied to the United States Navy. Over the years, we've heard often about the 60,000 to 70,000 Russians in Cuba. But how often have we heard our Robotoid President say in a press conference, as he did just 2 nights ago, quote, "I think one of the points that should be made is that a year ago we had 70,000 Americans in Iran, 70,000, unquote. Iran was becoming a great engine of war, fueled by Iranian oil, and at the controls sat the Shah of Iran, a puppet of the Rockefeller cartel. But the strength of the Shah was also his weakness. His secret police force, the Savak, was hated and dreaded universally by Iranians. As many as 60,000 Iranians may have died at the hands of the Savak, many of them under torture. And meanwhile, at the urging of his then-masters, the Rockefellers, the Shah was trying to remake Iran in the Western mold. Some Iranians welcomed these changes, but others only resented them. To them, Western influences, especially from America, met support for the Shah's reign of terror. This turned everything Western into a symbol of hate and fear, and most of all, millions felt that the Shah was turning Iran away from her ancient roots as an Islamic society. Islam was founded 1,400 years ago by the Prophet Muhammad. Muslims believe that God communicated directly to Muhammad through the angel Gabriel, and that Muhammad wrote those words down. The collection of these writings is known as the Quran. The religion based on the Quran is called Islam, and its adherents Muslims. Islam is a major force in the world, especially in the Middle East, Africa, and Southern Asia. There are as many Muslims in the world as there are Roman Catholics, around 700 million, and yet most of us in the West have no understanding at all of Islam. Instead, we are in the habit of looking at the Muslim world through Western eyes, and that always leaves us bewildered. Our ignorance of Islam is so great that not so long ago Muslims were typically called Mohammedans by Western Christians, and since we Christians worship Christ, it is often assumed that the people we wrongly call Mohammedans worship Mohammed. But nothing could be more offensive to a Muslim. The basic tenet of Islam is that there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. Allah is the Muslim name for God. Muhammad's memory is loved and revered but he is not worshipped. The Quran, the holy book of Islam, is not a book of laws, nor is Muhammad thought of as a lawgiver like Moses. Instead, the Quran is an eloquent appeal to mankind, and especially to the Arabs, to obey the law of God. Over and over the Quran states that the law of God has already been revealed to the Jews and to the Christians. In fact, in one passage, the Quran tells the pious Muslim, if he has any doubt, to consult those to whom the Scriptures have been revealed previously. Even so, it is a great mistake to expect Muslims to think in terms that are familiar to us. For one thing, we in the West tend to separate religion from other areas of life, such as business, law, and diplomacy. To a devout Muslim, this is unthinkable, for in Islam, religion is life itself. In the present crisis over Iran, several very important points of Muslim law and diplomacy are involved. The Muslim approach in these matters is not the same as in the West. Instead, they have been derived down through the centuries from the Quran, from examples set by the Prophet himself, and from other sources. Once you become aware of these things, I think the Iran crisis may begin to take on a different appearance in important ways. I'm about to give you several important quotations from a highly authoritative book on these matters. It is titled Law in the Middle East, Volume 1, by Majid Kaduri, K-H-A-D-D-U-R-I, and Herbert J. Lebesny. It was published in 1955 by the Middle East Institute here in Washington, D.C. First, in the West we generally think in terms of separation of church and state, but, quote, Islam, in contrast to Christianity, combined both the religious and civil authority in the hands of the head of the state, unquote. Before Islam was founded, the Arab world was a scene of continual fighting, intertribal warfare, with raids for robbery or vendettas. But, quote, Islam abolished all wars except the jihad, that is, the holy war, unquote. It had to be, quote, war that would spread the belief in Allah and make His word supreme over the world, unquote. No other kind of war was legally permitted. In addition, the jihad, quote, had to be conducted according to certain specific rules in order to be just. The violation of these rules deprived the jihad of its religious sanction and entailed punishment by Allah or the Imam, whether in this world or the next, unquote. The first of these rules is that, quote, the jihad was a required duty of the whole Muslim community, binding the Muslims in mass rather than individually, unquote. The second rule is that, quote, the jihad may be regarded as a doctrine of permanent war, unquote. But thirdly, quote, the jihad, though a doctrine of permanent war, did not necessarily mean continuous fighting. The objective of the jihad was not fighting per se, but the conversion of unbelievers to Islam. If means other than fighting were used, such as propaganda or persuasion, then the jihad duty was fulfilled. The essence of the doctrine was that the Muslims could not relax their effort to convert the unbelievers, unquote. And finally, quote, the validity of the jihad depended on the observance of certain rules. The Imam had to declare the jihad, to invite the unbelievers to adopt Islam before fighting began, and to agree to negotiations if they were requested by the enemy before actual fighting had taken place, unquote. Beyond these general rules, there is one more point of Islamic law which bears directly on the present Iran crisis. It has to do with the treatment of hostages. Quote, the system of taking human hostages to ensure the sanctity of treaties was followed by the Muslims. If the treaty were violated, however, the Muslims did not kill the hostages. If the Muslims started the war, the hostages were sent back home. But if the war was started by the other party, then the hostages were kept." Unquote. In other words, my friends, under Muslim law, the worst that can legally be done to hostages is to keep them indefinitely. Their position as hostages cannot justify their being killed. The hostages in Tehran, my friends, are there in connection with a jihad led by Ayatollah Khomeini. He has publicly proclaimed that Iran is embarked on a holy war against America, the great Satan, quote unquote. He has called upon all Muslims everywhere to join in the struggle, and yet the Ayatollah is being manipulated by forces which he may not understand. When the Shah was in power, he was building up Iran for war purposes which had nothing to do with the jihad, and as he westernized his country, he also terrorized it. As a result, many pockets of discontent and opposition developed against the Shah. One of the most forceful of these was Ayatollah Khomeini. Ayatollah Khomeini was an implacable foe of the Shah for many years before we began hearing about him here in the United States. The Ayatollah had good reason to know the character of the Shah's regime. Years ago, the agents of the Shah tortured and murdered one of the sons of the Ayatollah, and a generation ago, the present Shah's father executed Ayatollah Khomeini's father. And so even when he was driven into exile, the Ayatollah did not cease in his efforts against the Shah's regime. From his places of exile, he continued to appeal to his followers in Iran. He exhorted them to turn away from the Shah and turn back to Islam. And in accordance with the Shiite Muslim beliefs, he extolled martyrdom in service to God as something to be desired. He told his followers to oppose the Shah without fear, accepting martyrdom as a reward if it should come. The Ayatollah spent 14 long years in exile, most of them without seriously threatening the Shah's regime. And yet, early this year of 1979, Ayatollah Khomeini returned in triumph to Tehran. In less than a year's time, a revolution had suddenly crystallized around him. The sudden rise in the Ayatollah's political fortunes took place for reasons he could never have suspected. It all began 2 years ago this month in November 1977. In mid-month, the Shah of Iran made a sudden rush-rush trip here to Washington, D.C., but news about the Shah's mysterious trip was practically lost in the headlines about another unexpected rush trip. It was the week of the trip to Jerusalem by Egypt's President Sadat. The two trips were closely related, as I revealed that month in AUDIO LETTER 28. 2 months earlier, Russia had begun the rapid deployment of a secret arsenal of space weapons, her new Space Triad. The controlled Carter administration was reeling from the shock, but in November 1977, the sudden trips by Sadat and the Shah were the shaky beginnings of America's shift to a first-strike strategy. When the Shah discovered just how crucial Iran was becoming militarily, he decided to demand better reimbursement by the Rockefeller cartel for services rendered. A consortium of 14 oil companies marketed Iran's oil under contract, and it was contract renewal time. The Shah said he was willing to renew, but only on more favorable terms. Hearing that and other demands, the late David Rockefeller began thinking his Shah was expendable, and this new situation might offer an opportunity to get rid of British Petroleum as an unwanted partner. Originally, the Iranian oil fields had been controlled by Britain, but in 1953 the Rockefellers had acquired major concessions in Iran as the price of restoring the pliable Shah to his throne. By 1977, BP was down to only a 40% share in Iran's oil, while the Rockefeller cartel controlled 49%. But as usual, David Rockefeller wanted the whole pie. British Petroleum was an arch rival to be knocked out if possible, and so Rockefeller gave an assignment to what was then still his private detective agency, the CIA. They were to figure out how to get rid of the Shah in such a way that it would also knock out BP. but the CIA was also ordered to make sure that any plan they developed could also be used militarily. The CIA planners concluded that the only way to get rid of British petroleum in Iran would be to disband a consortium of oil companies. In other words, the Shah should be removed in favor of someone who would nationalize the Iranian oil industry. For decades, the Rockefellers had made a specialty of re-establishing their own effective control over nationalized industries, as I have indicated in AUDIO LETTER No. 40 about Guyana and other tapes. As for the military factor, surprise had become the number one consideration. In view of Russia's newly deployed space triad, most of the Shah's expensive weapons were no longer of much use. They could still be used in regional conflicts, but that was no longer of interest. Nothing mattered anymore except the ability to mount a surprise attack on Russia from Iran. And that would have to be done using secret weapons instead of the Shah's impressive-looking conventional weapons. So it was concluded that there was no military reason not to overthrow the Shah, and in fact, overthrowing the Shah held out the possibility of greater military surprise against Russia. To do this, the new regime would have to be one that did not want to continue the Shah's military programs. That would cause a dramatic collapse of Iran as a highly visible military threat to Russia. But it was also essential that whoever followed the Shah be less efficient organizationally than the Shah. This would allow covert activities to continue in Iran without the new regime being aware of it. The CIA then carried out a search for a candidate individual or group to replace the Shah. They were not looking for a puppet this time. Instead, the concept was to find someone having certain characteristics who could be maneuvered without their knowledge into serving the intended purposes. The search ended by identifying Ayatollah Khomeini. He fit the profile of desired characteristics. He was violently anti-Shah. His position as a religious leader provided an ideal base for political power, yet his group was weak organizationally and lacked administrative experience. Even the Ayatollah's fascination with martyrdom looked ideal to the war planners, because the government of Ayatollah Khomeini is to be sacrificed to a military purpose. It is Guyana all over again, but on a grand scale. 1 year ago this month, as I reported in AUDIO LETTER No. 40, the deliberate mass human sacrifice at Jonestown had a military purpose. It was to achieve surprise and the destruction of the secret Russian missile base about which I had warned publicly for over 4 years. This time, human sacrifice in Iran is intended to lead to the destruction of Russia herself. And so after a dozen years in obscurity, the cause of Ayatollah Khomeini suddenly started picking up steam. In countless ways, the CIA began multiplying Khomeini's impact in Iran. Cassette tapes of the Ayatollah's fiery speeches flooded the country. Photos of the Ayatollah began to multiply, becoming a rallying point for opposition to the Shah, and covert CIA agents began organizing the pro-Khomeini opposition to the Shah into a potent political force. And in the process, the powerful Bolsheviks here in America were able to put some of their own agents close to the inner circles of Ayatollah Khomeini. In August 1978, I alerted my listeners that the rioting in Iran was a serious threat to the Shah's regime. 4 months later, in AUDIO LETTER No. 41, I reported that none other than the Shah's former supporters, the Rockefeller Cartel, were causing his troubles. By early the following month, January 1979, the Shah's regime was visibly falling apart. The deputy to General Alexander Haig, the NATO commander, was then sent to Iran on orders from Washington. There he met with top Iranian military leaders. Following orders, the NATO deputy commander, Major General Robert E. Heiser, talked Iran's military out of staging a coup d'etat. Washington's unstated purpose in ordering General Heiser to Iran was to clear the way for Ayatollah Khomeini. The old Hegelian principle thesis, antithesis, and synthesis was at work. Step 1. Remove the powerful Shaw. Step 2. Replace him with an interim straw man, the unpopular Bakhtiar government. And Step 3. Allow this weak straw man to be knocked down by Ayatollah Khomeini. But the Rockefeller cartel was afraid the Iranian military would substitute their own Step 3. The military wanted to set up a stable, moderate pro-West regime. The CIA first strike planners wanted anything but stability in Iran, and so the Iranian military leaders were talked out of staging a coup. Later on, they were tried for treason and executed by the Khomeini government. On January 16, 1979, the Shah fled from Iran. Barely 2 weeks later, on January 31, the Ayatollah made his triumphal return to Tehran. The unseen, unsuspected CIA support for the Islamic Khomeini Revolution had done its job. That is what CIA Director Stansfield Turner meant in a statement he made only 4 days later on February the 4th. On the ABC television news program Issues and Answers, Turner said, quote, "I would suggest even Ayatollah Khomeini didn't realize how well his force was moving along." Unquote. Even so, an event took place only 1 week after the Ayatollah's return which might still have ended the Khomeini Revolution. When the old man and some aides came out the door of the Khomeini headquarters on February 7, 1979, an assassin was waiting. He shot the old man in the chest with an arsenic-coated, high-powered bullet. All efforts to save him were useless, and that night the old man died. For several hours, the British news agency Reuters carried bulletins that the Ayatollah had been reported killed. But there were no such bulletins by American news agencies, because the Rockefeller cartel here knew that Ayatollah Khomeini was not dead. The old man who was shot to death in Tehran last February 1979 was a double. He was a devoted Shiite follower of his beloved Ayatollah Khomeini. He knew, like everyone else in the Khomeini inner circle, that efforts would be made to assassinate the Ayatollah. But as a devout Shiite Muslim, the double welcomed the prospect of martyrdom as a sacred privilege. And so he willingly gave his life to ensure the success of the Islamic Khomeini Revolution. And as we all know, the revolution did succeed. But the cruel fact is that it was secretly helped along by satanic forces who planned to undo it all. They planned to martyr the entire Khomeini government as they set off thermonuclear war.